Empathy's beautiful, but we're so close emotionally in the other person's shoes that we take on the other person's pain and we burn out. So if we can step back emotionally just a little bit, we practice compassion.
Hi, welcome to Resonate, conversations and life lessons from Rancho La Puerta. I'm Barry, and today you are joining me at our labyrinth. A labyrinth is a form of walking meditation. Meditation can take many different forms. For me, meditation is anything that quiets your mind so you can listen to that inner voice. Some people call that your soul, your essence, your intuition. It doesn't matter to me what you call it. I have found from personal experience that when I listen to that voice, it always leads me closer to my authentic self. I have had the pleasure of meeting today's guest several times here at Rancho La Puerta. Barry Curzon is an American physician who, even as a teenager, was interested in Eastern philosophy, particularly Buddhism. On his six-month visa, he traveled to India to study. Once there, he extended that visa. During his time there, he met the Dalai Lama and eventually became his personal physician, a job he's had now for 37 years. During his time knowing the Dalai Lama, he became a Buddhist monk, and he now divides his time between India and the world, teaching compassion, kindness, and love, and the benefits of quieting your mind. Hi, Barry. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Barry. Good to be with you again.
It's so good to see you. And you're in Japan today, and you're like, it's already tomorrow where you are for me.
yesterday for me, so I'm going back in time. You're going ahead in time.
That's ahead in time. Yeah. Time is a weird concept.
Time actually is a concept.
I'm glad you picked up on that. Yeah. I said it for a reason. I think it's an interesting story that you went for. Your journey is a U.S. trained medical doctor who ended up in India, somehow met the Dalai Lama, became his personal physician, were ordained as a monk, and now you also travel and teach about kindness and compassion. So let's go back a little. How did that happen? From becoming a doctor to ending up in India first?
Yeah. I've always been interested in Buddhist philosophy and psychology since I was in my, I think, teens. A couple of books on Zen Buddhism came to me. I read them, but I didn't understand anything. But something clicked, you know. It's like, I got to know what this is about. I think it kind of started there. And then when I sort of grew up, although I'm not sure I've actually grown up, but sort of grew up, I, you know, wanted to be a doctor since I was 10, when I was very sick with a brain abscess and nearly died, and just wanted to be like the neurosurgeon who saved my life. And then I pursued medicine at USC Medical School and practiced for about 7 years in Ojai, California. And then I practiced medicine for about 4 or 5 years at the University of Washington in Seattle, doing academic medicine. And then had an opportunity. I got a call from a friend, Alan Wallace, who at that time was a monk. He's no longer a monk. That he had been to in the mid-80s, been to a conference, a very small conference, the first Mind and Life Institute conference with the Dalai Lama, who made a public kind of request that a Western-trained physician come and interdigitate different health systems so that anyone could be available for a sick person when one wasn't working. So anyway, I went over, checked it out. I liked it. I went back. I was there on a six-month visa. They also wanted me to teach research methodology to their Tibetan medicine doctors, you know, they wanted to study their medicine. We did that. We took a research project looking at the efficacy of treating high blood pressure with Tibetan medicine. And when that project was over, I extended my visa and I wasn't ready to go back. I started studying Buddhism. I started doing meditation. And then a couple years later, maybe one year later or something, His Holiness the Dalai Lama called me into his residence and asked me, he said he wanted to go to Rio de Janeiro for a very important environmental conference. And his team, his office got word there was a cholera outbreak. So he basically asked me, was it safe to go? And I told him, you know, I was really nervous. And I said, Your Holiness, I think it's safe. You'll stay in a good hotel, clean water, clean food, and there's a vaccine. It's not 100%, but it's good. So he thanked me. I left. I heard through the rumor mill that he called in his Tibetan medicine doctor, Dr. Tenzin Chodak. And again, I heard through the rumor mill that Chodala told him, you know, don't go too risky. And then a week or two later, he calls me back in. He basically says, you know, I want to go. Give me that vaccine, please. And so I went and got the cleanest one. I gave it to him, and I'm rubbing it down. And as I'm leaving, you never show your back. I'm backing up. He reaches out, grabs my hand. He says, come with me. And he takes me into the next room where he was in half-day retreat and walks me three times around a big table filled with a pile of semi-precious stones. On the outside, on the walls, are glass shelves with old Buddha statues, like 1,000 years old, from the great saints and masters. And he's telling me the history of each one as we walk around clockwise three times. Then he drops my hand, says, wait here, looks at this pile of semi-precious stones for the longest time, pulls out a crystal the size of my little, almost the size of my little finger, which is on my altar in my room in Dharamsala. And then he pulls out a turquoise, which older Tibetans have told me is very old, and I always wear it around my neck. I don't know if you can see it, but there it is.
Yeah, I can see it. It's beautiful. Yeah.
That's sort of how I became his doctor. There's no card I have. There's nothing official on these kind of things. It's, but I've been his doctor ever since.
And during that time that you were there in India, you were treating people in the local community as well with Western medicine?
Yes, that's true. I was with Western medicine, but also working closely with Tibetan medicine doctors so that, you know, if I felt something could be treated better with Tibetan medicine, we would call them in, and often vice versa. They would call me in. They felt Western medicine was beneficial. So we were interdigitating different healthcare systems.
And how long had you been his physician before you decided to take the oath as a monk? I don't know if it's an oath. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it is like an oath. It's vows. We live by 253 vows. And so it's called ordination, as you know. And I've been ordained for 21 years, over 21 years. And I've been his doctor since 34 years. So maybe 13 years after I became his kind of his doctor, then I became a fully ordained Buddhist monk, Tibetan Buddhist monk.
And that was, you had always wanted to do that? Or you, during that time, you had decided that you would like to go down that path?
Yeah, it was a good question. It's a really gradual thing. I think I was thinking about it, you know, before I went to India a little bit, but much more when I was in India. And then I started doing meditation for 17 years. I was almost always doing meditation retreats. And during that time, it started coming up as something, you know, if at all possible, I would like to do a 3-year meditation retreat.
I think that you told me that His Holiness the Dalai Lama actually ordained you himself.
He did. Usually, you know, there's a big, you know, waiting list. So he ordains monks and nuns, I mean, separately, but he ordains them in groups of anywhere from 60 to maybe 100. But in my case, for reasons that are completely unknown, I was the only one. And there's two levels of ordination. There's a novice, and then you have to wait at least a year. Some people wait a whole lifetime and never move on to the fully ordained bhikshu. And so he was giving me the novice vows, just me and about 12 very senior lamas and geshes and rinpoches that help in the process. And we're done, and it was really early morning, and I'm walking out, and a friend of mine, his ritual master, made me a little breakfast. I ate it and I left. And then Tashila is calling me, Barry, come back. I said, "What? We're done, aren't we?" And he said, "I don't know, but the Dalai Lama, his holiness is calling you. Go back in." So I said, "Okay." And so, of course, I went back in. And then he gave me the full ordination without waiting the year or even a lifetime, right there and then on the spot.
So this is a question that maybe some of us don't know. What is the hardest thing do you have to give up things to become a monk? What is like what do you miss the most, or what do you have to give up that you missed or that you do miss?
Yeah. You sort of have to give up everything.
Okay.
I mean, it's not so much the things or people you give up, but it's the relationship. Mm-hmm. So you're trying to work on, and this doesn't come overnight, of course, not being attached.
Mm-hmm.
Still heart open and loving, but without any strings, without anything expected in return. So no attachment. We're working on, you know, as you become a monk, reducing your attachment to people, to things. So that means sex, we're celibate. It means alcohol. I mean, never was a big drinker, but, you know, I like to drink wine and beer and occasional mixed drink, but no alcohol. When I was younger.
And also, money too, right? I mean, you don't actively work and earn an income.
That is correct. So I haven't had a salary for 35 years. I travel extensively about half of the year, and all my expenses, travel, accommodation, food, is all picked up by basically who's ever inviting.
So there's probably one thing in your list that I wouldn't be able to give up, but we won't talk about that one. What I was going to also ask you, when did you start traveling? And did the Dalai Lama suggest that for you?
Yes. So, you know, I've been there 35 years living in Dharamsala. The first half, like 17 years, as I mentioned earlier, I was doing, you know, retreats, 2 month, 4 month, 1 year, 3 years, and many of those shorter several month retreats for 17 years. And then His Holiness called me in, and he basically said to me, I would like you to go out and teach. So I said, of course. And then about 17 years ago, his ambassador or representative to Japan invited me to give a lecture in Tokyo. And so I went, give a lecture. There was a big group. And afterwards, some of the Japanese people, said, would you like to come back? And you know, we have a group and you're welcome. And I said, sure, let's give it a shot. And now I've been coming to Japan over 50 times. And 14 years ago, we kind of made it more, a little bit more formalized. So we have a nonprofit group. Actually, it's a Shadan Hojing with a nonprofit direction, like a nonprofit, called Human Values Institute. And I'm here in Japan now. And I've just finished on my teaching cycle. We were teaching at a big company called Bridgestone with 80 of their very high executives, HR people, you know, about ethical leadership and compassion and meditation. And then we taught at the Yokohama City University Medical School, about 200 first-year medical and nursing students. We did programs on Shanti Deva, all about compassion and wisdom. We taught the Heart Sutra, all about wisdom. So those are the things we've just completed days ago here in Japan.
I know you're also involved in an organization in the U.S., Altruism in Medicine, the Altruism in Medicine Institute. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is that your roots in as a doctor in your medical field that led you to want to teach compassion and kindness in Western medicine?
Yeah, good question. I think partially, yes. I owe a huge debt to my mother, who is extremely loving and compassionate. And I think, you know, some of that I've imbibed, at least a little bit of that, from my mother. Also, His Holiness the Dalai Lama is one of the most compassionate people that I know. And I've learned and imbibed so much from him. So I think a combination of all of these things.
And you also, East Meets West, you have developed an app called AIMI, right?
Yes. So may I step back a moment? You asked about alternative in medicine Institute. If I could just say a couple words.
Please.
The app. Is that okay?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Good. Thanks. So Altruism in Medicine Institute is a nonprofit organization, 501c3, that we set up about 8.5, almost 9 years ago. And it's based now in Pittsburgh, and our offices are in the Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh. It's a fabulous museum. In exchange, they give us the office space. In exchange, I do programs with them and their folks. They're situated in the poor section of town in the north side of Pittsburgh, and they're kind of open. Their programs are open for free for the local community, and I participate in that. We do a lot of work in universities. We work a lot at the University of Pittsburgh. I'm on the faculty there as an adjunct professor in the Department of Psychiatry. They're actually, I'm up for promotion. They're trying to promote me to, I don't know, I'm not doing it. They're doing it for me. We work with the police in Pittsburgh, a lot with the nurses at UPMC and other healthcare organizations in Pittsburgh and around the state of Pennsylvania. We do work in Phoenix and also in Seattle, again, around compassion. And when we teach compassion, we have a two-pronged kind of approach. One is a direct approach, and often that's difficult for all of us, you know, to learn how directly to increase your compassion. It's not so easy. So what we spend time also doing is the indirect approach. We look at the blocks to compassion. One, try to recognize them, and two, teach methods to reduce them so automatically the compassion increases. Blocks such as anger, such as jealousy, pride, insecurity, these things. So that's kind of the core of what we teach. We teach a lot about moving beyond empathy to compassion because we get stuck in empathy. Empathy is beautiful, but we're so close emotionally in the other person's shoes that we take on the other person's pain and we burn out. So if we can step back emotionally just a little bit, a half step, we practice compassion, we are less likely to take on the other person's pain. We protect ourselves from burnout, and we have more cognitive, rational thinking ability available to help the other person reduce their pain and suffering. So we teach that a lot. And the other area we teach a lot is healthy self-confidence. Learn how to recognize and then transform when you're putting yourself down into sort of healthy self-confidence. And also when you're putting somebody else down, how to transform it into healthy self-confidence, which is putting nobody down. So that's kind of what we do. For the last 2.5 years, we've been working with an AI group out of Washington, D.C., and we've built this app. It's up and running. We're always modifying and getting it better. It's called AIMI Care, capital AIMI, lowercase CARE, AIMI Care. AIMI stands for Altruism in Medicine Institute. It's available for free and on Android and Google Play stores and iPhone.
Yeah, the App Store.
App Store. Yeah, in the app, we have embedded for healthcare professionals, particularly doctors and nurses, we have programs where they can get 12 hours of Category 1 credit towards their relicensure. That's called continuing medical education and continuing nursing education. But the app is really there for everyone. You don't have to be a doctor or a nurse. We are also developing an avatar, and the avatar is up. It's already on the app. Looks like me, talks like me. And right now we have textual communication, but very soon we'll be, you know, uploading all of the work we're making it to be audio, communication, the avatar with the person, the user who's on the app.
No, I'm going to download it just to see the avatar of you for sure.
Hello, I am David de la Paz. I have the honor to be one of the meditation teachers at Rancho La Puerta. I was invited to come here as a guest teacher 4 years ago. And I have to admit, when I first received that invitation, I was going through one of the darkest chapters in my life. I remember I took one of the first class that is offered to the guests on Saturday, which is called Set the Ranch Intention. And the teacher leading that class asked me to write down one word that best represented me. And I remember that my word was broken. But I have to admit that the moment I started walking on the ranch trails, the moment I allowed the nature of the ranch, the mountain, speak to me, when I finally released and surrendered, that's the magic of the ranch. It is truly transformative. The ranch is instrumental because it offers the environment that is ideal for healing and transformation.
So I love the fact that the medical community can get continuing education doing things that are about compassion and about self-care and those kind of things. I think that's wonderful. I heard you say one time emotional hygiene. What is emotional hygiene? Is it all those things you just talked about?
Yeah, exactly. So emotional hygiene is kind of the term we use for, you know, the developing compassion, both directly and indirectly, particularly the indirect approach where we recognize and transform anger, jealousy, pride, and insecurity into their healthy opposites, like patience or tolerance, appreciation, humility, and healthy self-confidence. And so all that comes under the rubric of emotional hygiene, hygiene from borrowed from public health to clean up and emotions. We know that to basically clean up our harmful emotions. Yes.
You had mentioned that your app, you worked with artificial intelligence or AI to develop that. With the huge surge in AI, and it's become so much a part of our society, it's only going to get more and more. Do you think there are some ethical issues there?
Definitely. And since we started, I've been having almost constant negotiations with the AI side of our team, you know, to make sure that we have proper guardrails, that you can't put something through my mouth that I wouldn't feel happy about. So I've been assured multiple times that the guardrails are the only content that is going to be used that will be associated with the avatar are the content in the app. So I'm hoping, and I feel reasonably confident to allow it to go forward, that will be the case, so we won't have all this kind of junk that can be on the internet and really harmful stuff sometimes too. That stuff won't be part of the possibilities that come out of my mouth as the avatar.
I can see with you being able to control your avatar, but I'm more concerned globally about everything that's happening right now. And I don't know, how do we tie that in and have someone like you to pay attention to that?
Yeah, it's an amazing question. It's a huge issue. People are becoming more and more aware of it. You know, they say that about 80% accuracy is the best they can do with a generative AI like ChatGPT-4, okay? Mm-hmm. They can't even get 80%. And the rest of it is going to be junk. They call it hallucination. And some of it can be extremely harmful. It can be, you know, extremely bad, negative stuff. In the end of October 23, I was invited to give a talk at a new group that was forming. It was their inaugural event called Benevolent AI Future. And I gave a talk. They asked me to talk about compassion and healthcare connected to AI, or AI in compassion and healthcare. And I did. And they seem to appreciate this a lot. And afterwards, we've had many conversations and invitations to other related AI, ethical AI conferences and groups. And so that's starting to roll out more and more. How much impact they're going to have is really debatable, you know, because the bottom line is that these companies that have, they kind of run the world because they're, you know, going towards $1 trillion, some of these companies like Apple and Google and Microsoft and OpenAI, which is funded primarily by Microsoft, you know, the bottom line is going to be profit for these guys. So they're going to make the final decisions. So it's a very difficult, you know, question. I think all of us should get involved in any way we can, because we all use, or almost all of us use social media in some way, and bring it to the attention to the social media folks that you're concerned about this and you want to know what they are doing to try to put up, you know, adequate guardrails to protect all of us.
We'll switch from that a little bit, but if someone wants advice, what are some practical things someone can do to add more meaning in their life, do you think?
You know, you use this word at the very beginning, and the word is kindness.
I have a tattoo to my arm, so.
I love it. So maybe we all need to tattoo kindness on our arm so we don't forget. That's kindness for others, but it's also kindness for ourselves. We tend to beat ourselves up a lot. And so remembering many times a day, kindness, take a few slow, deep breaths, do something, even something very simple, like take a break, you know, for a minute in what you're doing. Walk out if there's a tree or a garden or nature around you. Walk out in the garden or the tree, around the trees in nature, just for a minute or a couple of minutes when you can. At the end of the day, we tend to remember, let's say we did 100 things. We tend to remember, and 10 of them didn't go well, 90 of them went well. You know, we tend to focus and remember the 10 that didn't do well. It's okay to look at those and, you know, try to make a plan to do better. We generally don't, but we try. But also remember the 90 and celebrate, you know, feel good about the 90. Actually celebrate that. That's kindness towards yourself. That's very important. And then all the ways that you know how to be kind to yourself. Often we say, I'm really good at being kind to other people, but I don't know how to be kind to myself. Okay. So remember all the ways that you're good at being kind to others, and then just sometimes reverse it and use those things, you know, towards yourself to be kind to yourself.
Now, I know that you have written four books, you've done four TED Talks. No Fear, No Death. Is that your most recent book?
Almost. The most recent book is The Wisdom of Nagarjuna.
Okay.
Yes, it's a deep dive into Buddhist wisdom. And that came out, I think, a year or two after the No Fear, No Death book.
So the book No Fear, No Death, is that a pun on the fact that the biggest fear that all people have is death?
Well, that's lovely the way you say that. Partly, you know, it also means that when we have absolutely no fear and absolutely no preconceived ideas, we're moving towards a very pure state of being. And when we attain this purest state of being of omniscience or enlightenment, which is Buddhahood, at that stage, we don't die. There's no death. So maybe both.
Yeah, well, that's beautiful. I love that. How many hours a day do you meditate?
You know, now I'm quite busy teaching, so I don't the time I'm trying to make it to be in a more intensive retreat situation where we meditate four sessions a day, each session 2 hours about. When I'm not in retreat, such as today and these days, I'm meditating 2 hours in the morning, sometimes a little more, and then in the evening, anywhere from about 45 minutes to an hour.
Okay, so I think that would scare the normal person. So is there another word that you could give to meditate? And a minute of meditation is better than zero meditation, right?
There are two types of meditation. Mm-hmm. One type is concentration. We call that shamatha or focused or concentration meditation. The other term for that is mindfulness. Now, there's two types of mindfulness. One is concentration meditation. I call that mindfulness with a small m. Mm-hmm. Mindfulness with a capital M is observing in the present moment your own inner life. What am I thinking? What am I feeling in the present moment? Again, repeating now, mindfulness with a small m is concentration meditation. The other type of meditation is contemplative or analytic, where we actually think about a topic such as love or kindness or wisdom, etc. So coming back to your question, is there another term for meditation? The answer is yes. For concentration meditation, it's mindfulness with a small m.
Mm-hmm. There is a lot of scientific evidence showing that meditation is good for you physically, and people feel better well-being-wise when they do one form of meditation or another. Is this true?
This is very true. In terms of compassion and meditation on compassion or reflection on compassion, there's a wonderful book written about 2 years ago or three called Compassionomics, written by two docs, and they were naysayers in terms of thinking that there was no place for compassion in healthcare. But they had a little doubt. They reviewed the literature extensively for several years, and they wrote this book, and they came to the opposite conclusion, that there's every place for compassion for healthcare providers, for patients, for families, for everyone who works and supports the whole network and system of healthcare. In terms of depression, there's very good research showing that basically a type of concentration meditation improves depression. In fact, it's equal with the newer form of antidepressants, the so-called SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which are like Zoloft, these mm-hmm. kind of drugs, that they're similar efficacy to reduce depression as from meditation. So meditation and medication, equally effective. There's very good work in OCD, obsessive compulsive stuff, can be reduced through meditation. Very good stuff through general neuroses, anxiety and fear, reduced through meditation. Even wound healing is faster through meditation and practicing kindness. This is some new stuff last few years coming out of Stanford Medical School. There's some epigenetic improvement, which increases longevity, which is now being proven by small pilot studies. So they're good. The design of the studies is good, but we need more bigger, robust studies to really nail it down. So we could say there's a suggestion that some of your epigenetic stuff, which is stuff that you carry with you almost instantaneously. It's not like genetics that takes many, many, many generations to manifest. This stuff is almost immediate. So that means that when you meditate and you create more calm environment, maybe more kindness through practicing kindness and compassion, that stuff then gets sort of crystallized, isn't the right word, but it mm-hmm. gets encoded in the surrounding stuff in the microenvironment around the DNA, and it affects the how the DNA has its three-dimensional shape. And this has to do then how it functions. And so that stuff gets carried down. And the longevity stuff also seems to get carried down. So meditation seems to help you live longer, but we need more research to really to make that more secure, that finding. Things like, inflammation is reduced. So there's some good studies showing that IL-6, interleukin-6, it's a whole complex system of hormones that basically is related to inflammation. And there's some very good research showing that more meditation, much less interleukin-6. Interleukin-6 is directly correlated to inflammation in the body. And we now know that so much chronic disease is associated with inflammation in the body. So it looks like that meditation will be able to help reduce the impact of many chronic diseases associated with inflammation.
I think I heard you say in one of your talks at one point that we are innately compassionate. Infants are born compassionate. So something happens along the way, so you can enhance it and bring it back, which I think is wonderful.
Barry, you know, you would have made a wonderful doctor. And I know you were thinking of going to medical school. You may have even applied and gotten in. I'm not sure.
I did, yes.
You did, yeah. Your memory is incredible. The way you think is very clear. And your kindness and compassion comes through so often. I think you would have made an excellent physician. And in a way, you're practicing medicine, healthcare in a way that helps people, you know, with wellness. And in a sense, that's really being a physician. So I forgot your question.
No, I was just talking about how you know, we are born compassionate people, innately compassionate. So I think that it's good to think about that on a regular basis, you know, that it's part of who we are. It's part of our essence. So I love that.
There is some good research. Some of the research is out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, looking at infants that are 3 or 4 months old, and they, you know, prop them up. Sometimes they have to hold them up, you know, and they look at a video screen. And in the screen is an infant of a similar age rolling a ball, big ball, uphill. And you watch the real infant smiling, coming closer, feeling very happy. And then the next scenario is the same, but there's a third infant in the video blocking the ball going up the hill. And then you watch the real infant and the kid goes back, looks very frightened, maybe even cries. So that's some of the research from which they base this innate, born with compassion understanding.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So I want to be cognizant of your time and the time for the podcast. So I want to tell you, I really appreciate you spending time with me today. And I hope that you'll make it back to the ranch at some point. I know that we really love having you here. I think you've been here twice, is it? Or three times, maybe?
I think as a teacher, maybe three times. And then as a friend of a friend, maybe twice. So four or five times. Cool. I would love to come back. And it's in the mix. We'll just have to get the scheduling to agree.
Well, I have to tell you that you're one of my favorite people on the planet. I just love seeing you, spending time with you, being in your presence. And thank you so much for spending this time with us. And
I will see
you soon, I hope.
Good.
Thank you so much, Barry. I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. As you can see, I could talk to Barry for hours. In fact, I've done just that here at the ranch on several occasions. What resonates for me today in our conversation is that compassion is innate. We are all born with compassion. We just need to find ways to reconnect and enhance it. Barry teaches that compassion starts with oneself. Once your cup is full of love and compassion, then it can spill over to those around you. When I asked Barry what is the one thing he thinks this planet needs more of, the answer was kindness. My wish is that we could each have more grace, compassion for ourselves. And that would spill out as kindness. This is Barry, not the monk, wishing you health and daily joy.